Consequence Podcast Network.
This week on The Sidetrack, we'll be joined by prolific writer, director, producer, and actor Edward Burns, who, for a kid on Long Island with no industry connections, turned his passion into productivity, into a Sundance Grand Jury Prize for his film, The Brothers McMullen. We'll also talk about his pick for his feature-length audio commentary, the 1983 Robert Duvall starring Tender Mercies. That's this week on The Sidetrack. Welcome back to yet another edition in a brand new season, season two of The Sidetrack. It's me, your host, Paul Davidson, rocking the morning voice. It's not sickness. It's early in the day. We're recording this episode, the premiere episode of our second season. And it's just plain par for the course, this trailer voice in a world where feature-length audio commentaries are paired up with the most fascinating interviews ever. Well, I'm excited. I'm thrilled to kick off the new season with none other than writer, producer, director, actor, editor, God, the list goes on and on, Sir Edward Burns. No, he was not knighted by the Queen, but with such a prolific career, should we not add Sir in front of his name? You think you know just how much this man is producing. The level of product that he is writing and directing and producing is going to make your head spin. Okay, it threw me off my game just there for a second. I couldn't even enunciate how stunned I was to realize just how much this man has going on. Yes, of course, you can start with things like The Brothers McMullen. Of course, the Sundance Jury Prize winning film that he shot for $25,000 and went on to gross $10 million. He went on to shoot films, write, direct, and produce films like She's the One, No Looking Back. He built a whole acting career in films directed by other folks like Spielberg, his role in Saving Private Ryan. Every 2 to 3 years, this man is writing, producing, and directing a film. He's acting. He's producing television. His most recent series, Bridge and Tunnel, just premiered in January of this year on Epix. There's a lot to talk about. So, we're going to do that. I do want to say this season is going to be fun. So, buckle up and get ready for some amazing conversations with some amazing people. I'm thrilled to be back, thrilled to be partnered with our friends at Consequence of Sound. And, hell, let's just get going, right? So, sit back, get ready, and here's my little chat with none other than Sir Edward Burns here on The Sidetrack. So here we are with, as I say in the opening, and you haven't heard it yet, Sir Edward Burns, because I find that someone should add that to the front of your name, because clearly the prolificness of your career deserves some additional title on the front of your name. How are you, Ed?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
So I've been asking people this question. I've always started with this, especially in this day and age. How has the last year impacted your ability to be creative, to be able to write? Clearly, it impacts production, and we'll talk a little bit about how that impacted Bridge and Tunnel. But how has it impacted your ability to be creative?
You know, I have always been pretty lucky in that, you know, when I first started trying to write screenplays, I had a full-time job as a production assistant, and I worked very sort of odd hours. You know, I could have to be in at 6 a.m. and then work a 14-hour day. So I kind of had to learn how to write whenever I had a free half hour. And if that meant, you know, writing longhand on the subway on my way to work, or, you know, basically anywhere, I could do that. So that, let's say, early day training as a writer has benefited me, because, you know, I now am in the habit of writing every day. If I'm working on a screenplay, or a television show and I hit the wall, I know I have to write that day. So I just put that one down and pick up another script that I'm working on.
And is that how you deal with, I mean, to your point, I guess when you hit a wall where you're not feeling the inspiration of one thing, do you pivot and just jump into the next thing? And that's how you keep yourself productive?
Exactly. You know, I mean, I find like I feel guilty if I haven't written on any one day. You know, I feel like I busted my ass for all those years to try and get into the business. And then once you're in, it's such a blessing that I thought, well, you know, I'll never not sort of be respectful of that blessing. And that means making sure that every day I'm writing. So, you know, I don't think I ever get writer's block. There are days where it's just like, I'm not feeling it maybe with that particular screenplay. And I've also found that anytime you put something down for a week or even a month or sometimes even 6 months and you come back to it, you are so, you can see the thing so much more clearly. You're not so up in it the way you are when you're in the process of, you know, creating it for the first time. But it also enables you not to be so precious about the material and you forget how many hours you may have worked on that scene. And you just read it now and you're like, oh, actually that scene's pretty terrible. let me just delete it and start over.
All right.
So that's been helpful. So anyhow, the long answer to your question is, and everybody was dealing with and still dealing with all sorts of different levels of anxiety, uncertainty during, you know, this last year during the pandemic. The way I really dealt with that was 10 o'clock every morning, 2.5, 3 hours, turn off my Wi-Fi and just write. And that was, I think, a real saving grace for me.
So as I said just a few minutes ago, I mean, people, you utter your name, writer, director, producer, some will actor, Edward Burns. People have immediately pops to mind a certain list of movies and credits. What's insane to me is on average, just put the television stuff and the acting stuff aside for a second. Every 2 to 3 years since the Brothers McMullen, you are writing, producing, directing something. It may be a $5 million movie. It may be it may be a much smaller budgeted film. But you are consistently putting stuff out, which I find super impressive. And clearly, based on your, you know, you talk about your schedule every day, hell or high water, you are writing, you are working on something, which is impressive. In those years, was there a moment, a time when that productivity, that being so prolific, hit a brick wall? Has that ever happened to you? Because when you look at the list, it feels like to me this is a freight train running at 100 miles an hour from day zero.
I'd say yes, I absolutely ran into a brick wall, but it wasn't due to my inability to create. It was more my inability to make a movie that made any money. I had done probably 4 films in a row, and it's connected to writing. And for my first 4 films, you know, from McMullen through Sidewalks of New York, I was religious about outlining before I sat down to write a screenplay. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of people who say, you know, they don't outline and they don't like to outline and they don't want to follow a traditional Hollywood 3-act structure. I was taught that structure in film school coming up. So I was a great student of that and always applied that to every script before I sat down to write. I beat it out an outline according to the 3-act structure. I don't know if it was due to laziness or arrogance, but I got away from that. And then I followed those first 4 films with 4 more films, none of which were successful, all of which, when I look at now, are great disappointments to me. Not that I didn't have a great time making them,
yeah.
Got to work with, you know, some incredible actors, made a ton of great friends, had a great time making them. But when I look at them, I see that, you know, that adherence to structure, I think, hurt those movies. And I made a movie called Ash Wednesday, Looking for Kitty, The Groomsman, and Purple Violets. And, you know, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Independent Ed, where I go into each one of the films and how we got a finance and how we made them and then, you know, how we distributed them. And all 4 of those face their own obstacles as far as getting them financed, getting them made. But all 4 really had challenges getting out into the marketplace. So anyhow, after those 4 films, I had another script that I did not outline. It was called Stoolie, and it was kind of my attempt at maybe something like an out-of-sight kind of gangster film. I thought it was like, oh, maybe I need to change my genre. And we spent a year trying to get that, or probably maybe even 2 years, probably trying to get that movie financed. We did what, you know, you and I were discussing before the call about trying to get actors attached. That took a good solid year. We finally put together a pretty nice cast, and then a year trying to put together the financing, couldn't get the financing. Finally find myself up in the Hollywood Hills having a meeting with this so-called production company. And it was definitely, you know, I mean, it was a, these weren't quite sort of, these were people definitely like on the fringe of the business.
Sure.
I don't want to badmouth anybody, but.
Money in a backpack.
And, you know, Aaron Lubin, my producing partner, who I've been working with forever, we left that and we went for a drink and we're like, okay, so this is what they mean by director's jail. Like, we are in it. We, you know, like, we can't get a movie made. What the hell are we going to do next? And that's when we came up with, over drinks, this idea to try and redo Brothers McMullen from a production standpoint. And right. We created this thing kind of like, you know, the old Dogma rules. We created the McMullen 2.0 rules.
Right.
So, you know, in Brothers McMullen, you know, we made it for $25,000. We shot it in 12 days. We used unknown actors. We used a three-man crew, and we didn't pay for any locations.
Yep.
And no hair and makeup, no wardrobe. Actors had to wear their own clothes. So we wrote down all the rules of that film. And the thinking was, you know, I was 25 years old when I made the movie. I had no connections. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And, you know, that movie worked out pretty well for me. So we said, let's just do that again just to get out of jail.
Yeah.
Let's just go have some fun making a movie. And at about that time, someone had given Aaron the, I don't know if you know this Blake Schneider book, Save the Cat.
Yep, of course.
Which is, you know, like a real simplified look at, you know, classic Hollywood structure for screenwriting. And I looked at that and then I was like, you know what? This makes a lot of sense. So I went back to my old notebooks from film school and dug out all my screenwriting notes. And you know, that film was, we eventually made it, called Nice Guy Johnny. And that's the, when I went back to outlining before writing, and that's what I've done. You know, that was 2009, I think. So for whatever, the last 12 years,
yep,
that's what I've been doing with everything I do. So the brick wall, you asked about was, you know, the business telling me you're done.
And the cat got you over the wall.
And the cat got, there you go. And the cat got me over the wall.
Well, so it's a great segue to do a quick flashback, because what I do want to talk about McMullen, not ad nauseum, because there's a lot of other new stuff to talk about. But one thing I wanted to hit on first are moments. Like, we all have moments where we decide to make a decision in our life that this is the path we're going to take. Now, you're born in Queens, you grow up on Long Island, you're going to State University, Albany, and somewhere in the midst of going to that college, you decide to leave your junior year and go to, it's Hunter College, right, in Manhattan to study
Hunter
film?
Hunter College, yeah, on 68th and Lex.
So before that moment, are you saying to, you grew up in a family where nobody has connections to the industry. Your dad's an NYPD cop. Your mom works for the FAA. When do you decide that this is what you want to do? And what is the catalyst for you making that decision to leave Albany and go to Hunter?
You know, when I'm in school, I'm an English major because I want to be a writer.
Okay.
I don't really know what that means exactly. Yeah. I'm thinking, you know, do I want to be a sports writer? Do I maybe want to go into the PR business, I thought, or do I want to be a novelist? You know, and you know, I was attempting to write a novel while in school and, you know, not getting very far with it. But if you were an English major, you could become a film studies minor. So I took a couple of those, you know, entry-level film appreciation classes, one of which was called Four American Directors, or Four Hollywood Directors. And it was John Ford, Billy Wilder, Orson Welles, and Hitchcock. And, you know, as a kid, I went to the movies on a Friday night. I was not a movie buff. So I had never heard of any of these filmmakers or their films. And one of the first films I saw in that class was The Apartment, yeah, the Billy Wilder movie, The Apartment. And I just fell in love with it, you know, and it's funny, you know, I look at my career since then and, you know, the Apartment is that incredible balance between comedy and drama.
Yep.
You know, I think that is the hardest thing to pull off. You know, if you're going to make a straight drama, you know, I'm not going to say that that's easy by any stretch, or a straight comedy is not easy by any stretch, but being able to find the right balance between the two, at least for me, those are my favorite films. Those are some of the films I've always been sort of attracted to. And that's what I've tried to do almost every time with my storytelling. But anyhow, I see The Apartment. I asked the professor afterwards, who's Billy Wilder? And he says, oh, well, he actually, you know, he wrote it and directed it. So I did some research on that. I told my dad about it. He then gets me the Sid Field screenwriting book.
Okay.
I take a look at that, and I within the pages of that, I see the format of a screenplay, which I'd never seen before. You know, I'd never even thought about it before, about where movies come from or the idea that somebody might write them. And I look at that, and I was like, okay. And it's, you know, for the most part, mostly dialogue. And I said, I think I want to take a crack at that. So I sit down, I abandon that novel I was working on, and I start to write my first screenplay. And I thought, when I finished it, I thought, well, I don't want to send this out to Los Angeles and have someone else direct it, because, you know, like most people's first scripts, it was very autobiographical. And I thought, well, I'm the only one who can tell this story. So I'll be, you know, I'll do the Billy Wilder thing. I'll be a writer director. And, you know, I've told this story before, but basically, you know, like you said, I'm a working class kid. I did not, you know, my family did not have any money. So I told my dad that I wanted to go to film school. And I was like, you know, maybe NYU or USC or UCLA. He's like, okay, yeah, look at those tuitions and let's rethink that. So I found Hunter College in Manhattan. And, you know, I'd have to move back home. And I was able to finally, you know, I went there for I never graduated. I'm still 9 credits shy, but I went there for 2 years and I basically just took every film class they offered.
So now how does your dad hook you up with a PA gig at Entertainment Tonight? This is Entertainment Tonight in New York, yes?
Yes. All right. So my dad, in the second part of his career in the PD, he works in an office called DCPI down in police headquarters.
Okay.
And that's I think it was the Deputy Commissioner's Office of Public Information. So basically my dad was the spokesperson for the police department in its relationship with the press. So, you know, like my dad from that position, and he did it for maybe almost 18 years, you know, he became very good friends with all of the journalists in New York. I mean, Jimmy Breslin was one of his best friends. And his you know, one of his most famous claims to fame was, you know, he gave the sort of official statement when John Lennon was assassinated.
Oh, wow.
So, and someone just sent me they had a recording of it on a tape from, you know, because it was just, I think, the 40th anniversary, right?
Yeah, that's right.
A couple of months ago.
Wow.
Somebody had it on their like mixtape and sent it to me. But anyhow, so through that, so he ends up, when I go to Hunter College, and I mentioned it's on 68th and Lex, around the block from Hunter was Channel 5 in New York, was the Fox. And he got me an internship after my first year at Hunter, working on the assignment desk for the local 7 o'clock news. And then from that, I then got a job answering the phones on Fox, had a show, which was their attempt at 60 Minutes. It was called The Reporters. So, you know, so for my second year at Hunter, I'm basically working full time at The Reporters and going to night school, which is probably also why I never graduated. and there was a woman there who ran the crews, you know, a film crew for any typical news magazine or you know, local news thing is a two or three man band, you know, camera person, sound person, and a production assistant. And she was leaving The Reporters and going over to Entertainment Tonight.
Got it.
So she's actually the one that said, hey, I can get you $18,000 a year if you're willing to leave here and go over to Entertainment Tonight with me.
Big money. Big money then.
Big money.
So the story's been told many times, but you're working at Entertainment Tonight. You team up with Dick Fisher, who was a cameraman at E.T. and ended up being the cinematographer for Brothers McMullen. You guys shoot this movie over 8 months on 16mm, 25-ish grand, and you're walking around with a rough cut on a tape that you, talking about moments, find an opportunity to slip to none other than Robert Redford.
Yeah, so, you know, at that point, I had said earlier, you know, the film had been done for maybe a year. I had sent it to, you know, I would go through the trades religiously every day looking for the name of any agent who had recently signed an unknown screenwriter.
Smart.
Or a first-time director. So I don't know how many dozens of VHS copies of...
That would be great to find on eBay.
So sent those out. I went to every film festival and then every production company. And we got nothing but rejections back. And we had even gotten... I'm trying to think if I had sent it to... Sundance yet. I can't really remember. But anyhow, we're doing an interview with Redford because he's promoting Quiz Show. And I have my VHS copy. And my plan is when the interview ends, and usually when we do these big junkets, they would rent out a couple of suites in a hotel. I knew that when the interview ended, Redford and his PR person would probably go out the main door. I was going to take my VHS copy because I didn't want my bosses to see me do this. I'd sneak out the other door in the suite, meet him at the elevator, and give him, I knew I would have probably 30 seconds to a minute to give him my spiel.
What's your spiel to Redford?
You know, it's basically like, hey, I know you're the godfather of independent film. I made this movie for $25,000. It's my labor of love. I shot it in my parents' house. I would love for you to take a look at it.
And what does Something he say like that. In that moment?
Short and sweet. And he, you know, he was great. I mean, he says, oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'll make sure that someone takes a look at it. And then he hands it to his PR person as the elevator doors close.
Oh, man.
So I'm thinking, well, you know, it was worth a shot. And then, you know, it's probably, I'm going to say a month later, maybe 2 months later, I get a phone call at work, and it's from Jeff Gilmore, who is the head of programming at the Sundance Film Festival.
Wow.
And my VHS copy was 2 hours long, and it said rough cut. He asks me, so, you know, it says here that, you know, your film is a rough cut. Did you finish the movie? I lie and I say yes.
Yeah.
He says, oh, what's the running time now? And, you know, it's funny, even just talking about Tender Mercies, that film is 95 minutes long.
Yeah.
And a lot of my, you know, a lot of my favorite films at the time, you know, a lot of the Woody Allen movies were about 90, 95 minutes long. So I said, oh, it's 95 minutes long. And he says, oh, what scenes did you cut out? And there were a couple of scenes I knew that I might want to cut out.
Yeah.
But I rattled off about five scenes like, oh, okay, good, good. That sounds good. Well, we'll be in touch. 2 weeks later, they call and say we're in. And then I have to scramble because not only do I have to cut a half hour out of this film, you know, we shot on 16, transferred everything to beta so that we could cut it at Entertainment Tonight their editing suites after hours, transferred the beta to VHS. So now I would have to basically go back to my 16, recut the film, and then blow it up to 35.
And, wow. I mean, so when the announcement comes out that the film has been selected among, I'm sure they put out the list as they normally do, is that when you start getting the calls? Is that when, you know, like the John Slosses and the Ted Hopes all kind of start getting involved to take it to Sundance with you?
I'm trying to remember if it happens on the announcement or if I had a connection. I'm trying to think. I mean, again, that's 27 years ago.
I know. But can you see in your head that moment where you introduce your film at Sundance?
Yeah. Well, I can tell the first, you know, I can remember going to Good Machine on West 25th Street, which, you know, if anybody is listening to this who lives in New York and knows what Chelsea looks like now, you know, West 25th Street for my first meeting with Ted Hope and James Shamus was probably like 4 p.m. By the time I got out of there, it was 7:00.
Yeah.
And that neighborhood was real sketchy once it got dark. They were on 25th, I think, right off of 10th Avenue. You know, I mean, gates on the, you know, full gates on the door. And,
yeah.
But anyhow, I can remember meeting with those guys and it was great. And they had some great ideas about what to cut in order to get it down to a half hour. I knew nothing about post-production. So, you know, they were going to walk me through and help me figure out how we were going to get our negatives out of from Duart and then get them into the Avid and then cut it. And Ted, you know, when we were down to cutting out, like, let's say the last 10 minutes of the movie, Ted gave me great advice that I still think about all the time. I was fighting him on these last probably three scenes.
Yeah.
And he gave me two bits of advice. He goes, Eddie, no one has ever walked out of a movie and said, or he said something like, everyone who walks out of the movie sometimes will say, oh man, it was a pretty good movie, but it was a little too long, right? There was that 20 minutes in the middle. Right. No one has ever walked out of a movie and said, oh man, that was too short.
Right.
So he says, let's get it down to 95. And he says, if those scenes are so great, hold on to them and you can use them in another screenplay. And, you know, any screenwriter knows that, you know, once you cut those scenes, you cut them for a reason. You very rarely go back to them. And it was great advice because that movie played real nicely, I thought, at 95 minutes. So then through those guys, I think, is how I meet John Sloss. But going into Sundance, I was very lucky because I had, you know, Good Machine and John Sloss on my team. And, you know, they really helped us when we eventually sold it to Fox Searchlight.
And this film was the first release of Fox Searchlight, isn't that right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's crazy. Like that's, I didn't know that until I did the research that Tom Rothman starts Searchlight and Brothers McMullen is that first release. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was great. And Tom was great and is still a good friend of mine. Yeah, and you can imagine, like I'm 26 when I get to the festival. I actually have my 27th birthday the night we win the grand jury prize.
Happy birthday.
But you had asked earlier about that first screening. I can remember, you know, I'm sitting in the Egyptian. I'm terrified because remember, we have to cut the movie, do the blow up, and I have to go to Sundance before the film is done to do some of the filmmaker stuff, you know, like there's a filmmaker breakfast.
Sure.
And I don't know if they still have any of that stuff, but those first couple of days, it was like a, you know, like get to know the other filmmaker things.
Yeah.
And so Ted has to stay in New York, you know, for an extra 3 days or something to wait for the lab to finish the blow up for 35. And of course it's like, oh man, what if there's a snowstorm and it doesn't get here, right. But he gets it. So I was sitting in the theater with the audience. I've never seen the film in this. Yeah. I've never seen it projected up on the screen, and I've never really seen this version of it with its final mix and everything. So I'm sitting in the middle of the theater, terrified. And, you know, I mean, it was great because it was a festival audience, and festival audiences, you know, at least sort of the US indie festivals. I think you have people there that love movies and appreciate movies and are there to have a good time with them. And that crowd just started laughing from the opening scene. And I had a woman sitting next to me and she says, you know, she could tell I was nervous. And she said, don't worry, I think they like it. And that was it, man. After that, you know, you go up on stage and you do the Q&A. And, you know, if you could ever pinpoint a moment where you knew that your life was never going to be the same, it was probably up there. And, you know, when the movie ends, there's a line of people up the side of the theater, you know, who want to give you their business cards. And it's, you know, agents and managers and,
amazing.
You know, I had, you know, a dozen lunch meetings set for LA, you know, minute I returned home to New York, you know.
That's amazing. And so Searchlight picks it up, a $25,000 budgeted movie, gets a $200,000 post-production budget, right? To finish, and it goes on to do $10 million. I think $10 million at the box office, I think it was the most, one of the most profitable indie films of the era, which is amazing. So, I mean, what a storybook moment. So then the question becomes for me is the aftermath of McMullen. So what for you, you go into this, I mean, like you can imagine the night before Sundance, the weeks before Sundance leading up, any normal human being has in their head expectations, hopes, dreams, etc. Question for you is, what happened that you were expecting? What happened that you weren't expecting? And did anything, was there anything you were hoping would come out of it that didn't?
Okay, a couple of things there. So, you know, when we do the deal with Tom Rothman and Searchlight, we did not sell the movie for a lot of money. The thinking was, you know, Clerks had come out the year before.
Yep.
I don't know what Clerks sold for, but I think Clerks did either 1 or 2 million in its initial box office run.
Right.
So the thinking was, you know, if you could get to $1 million for one of these micro budget indies, that would be, Yeah, that's an enormous hit and well beyond anyone's expectations. So we did a, you know, we sold the film for, you know, a low, low number, but there were box office bumps built into it. And the nice thing is, when the movie ends up making $10 million, because we sold it for such a low number and there were no expectations, it served us all pretty well.
Yeah.
Everyone got to make a decent chunk of change on that.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the nice, unexpected thing that happened, is that I actually made some money on it. I just, you know, I was hoping to get an agent. That was really all I thought. I thought the film would be a calling card.
Yeah.
You know, James Seamus, who was a good machine, he gave me great advice. He goes, look, you know, what you need to have at Sundance, because in those 10 days you're there, you will never, ever be hotter. Everyone is going to try and, you know, if the movie plays, everyone's going to want to be in business with you. So make sure you have another screenplay.
Right.
And I was telling you earlier that during the year where we couldn't sell McMullen, I sat down and sort of tried to improve upon that screenplay and write what I thought was the funnier version of McMullen. And, you know, that film was She's the One. So James is like, make sure you have a screenplay in your hands, because, you know, if this thing goes well, they're going to say, what do you want to do next?
Yep.
And you want to be able to hand them that screenplay, because you'll have more leverage in the heat of the moment.
Smart.
So, you know, that's what we did with Fox Searchlight. You know, Tom Rothman, you know, we became very good friends during the festival. We're spending a lot of time after we sell the movie to them. And he asked that question, what do you want to do next? I gave him She's the One. And by the time we got home, that movie was greenlit.
That's so amazing. And my gosh, I don't even know the percentage increase in budget, but from 25,000 to close to 3 million, that's a pretty nice uptick.
A pretty nice uptick, but you know, McMullen had done so well that we probably could have gotten a lot more than 3.
Yeah.
But I insisted that, you know, because at that time, I'm reading everything I can get my hands on about indie film and indie filmmakers. And I knew if I could make a lower budgeted second film, there's no way, you know, if I only lost the studio $3 million, I would get another crack at it.
Sure.
If I lost them $10 million, that might be, you know, that might be the sophomore jinx that has ended, you know, dozens of careers.
I mean, the same goes for like people who are writing novels. Like if you take a huge advance and your book fails, you're probably never going to get another advance. But if you take a low one and overperform or just perform fine, you probably have a next shot. So that's a smart approach.
Yeah, again, you know, I mean, I was lucky in having Ted and James as early advisors was great, you know, because they knew, you know, they had been working with Ang Lee and his first couple of films. So, you know, they knew how to make a $3 million movie in New York. And, you know, I mean, that was, again, I can remember, you know, first day on the set of that film, we were shooting a scene at JFK. And, yeah, you know, I just can't believe the size of the crew. Now, granted, you know, you hire all your department heads and you get to know everyone, and you're working with your costume designer and your production designer about the look of all the locations. Still, there's nothing that quite prepares you for showing up on day one. And there's a, you know, half of a terminal at JFK is closed for you, and you've got 100 plus people sitting there waiting for you to say, okay, here's where the camera is going to go, and this is what we're going to do. At 27, pretty heady stuff.
Well, and then to be able to cast at the time Jennifer Aniston and Cameron Diaz in key roles. And by the way, I'll touch on Tom Petty music in a sec. But for those two actresses, is that something that is Fox Searchlight sending them the script? They're aware of, you know, the last film and they sign on. Is it you having to sit down with them and kind of walk them through what you're hoping to do with that particular film? How does that play out?
No, because, you know, Jennifer and Cameron weren't Jennifer and Cameron then. You know, Jennifer is, I think, one season on Friends.
Okay.
So, you know, she's an actor on a successful sitcom.
Yep.
You know, like that, you know, that isn't a, you know, a movie star. So, you know, she came in to audition actually in the Fox Searchlight offices. And, you know, I mean, I was a fan. I thought she was hysterical. And when she came in, I mean, she just basically did one take of the first scene. And I was like, okay, you know, like, obviously,
yeah,
she's going to nail this part. You know, Cameron had done a couple of small parts and she had just done The Mask.
Got it.
The Jim Carrey movie.
Yep.
So again, not, you know, she's not, you know, no one probably knew who she was or knew her by name at that point.
Yeah.
But, you know, we also, and I, you know, I have to give the credit to, you know, my casting director at the time was Laura Rosenthal. And Laura basically auditioned every actress in New York and set up auditions for every actress in LA. And, you know, we auditioned everybody for that film. And, you know, two actors that auditioned for the two parts that Jennifer and Cameron got, who were sort of the runner-ups, we ended up casting in different roles, and that was Amanda Peet and Leslie Mann.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, my gosh. Clearly that movie, involvement in that movie, is a precursor to four pretty solid careers.
Yeah.
Now, how heady, even more than the actresses, is Tom Petty writing original music for your film?
Yeah, that was probably the, you know, the headiest of all the experiences, and still one of the craziest ones till this day, you know. Right. At that time, so the story behind that is when Searchlight was going to was releasing McMullen, they wanted, at the time, a lot of people were doing like an original song for the tail credits moment for movies.
Right.
So Fox wanted to do something like that for McMullen. And this is also a crazy story. I told them, in the way that you would only do when you're, you know, 27 and you don't know any better.
Right.
I said, well, you know, I don't think we can do that because this kid, Seamus Egan, did all the music for Brothers McMullen, and he did it all for free originally. And, you know, I don't know if you remember, but the music in McMullen is traditional Irish, like fiddle and right. flute music.
Yep.
So I said, well, you know, if we're going to get someone to replace his tail credit song, I think it should be someone that he approves of. Right. I'm sure Fox was like, who?
Yeah,
the
I'm sure they love that.
Is this kid? Is he kidding us? You want the Irish fiddle player to get approval over who we're going to do? Okay. So, but I felt like I owed it to Seamus. So he put a list together of four people. And the first one on the list was Sarah McLachlan.
Yep.
They went to Sarah McLachlan. They showed her the movie. And, you know, to everybody's surprise, she said, oh, I love it. Yeah, I would love to do the tail credit song. But she says, I love the song that's in there. Why can't I just write, you know, a melody and lyrics to that? And basically, that's what she did. And that song is Will You Remember Me, right? That's
Wait a second. One. I Will Remember You is a song.
I Will Remember You, yeah.
She wrote the song, the lyrics to the music that he had already written?
Yeah. So Seamus Egan, you know, he didn't make any money on, you know, his meager composer fee for Brothers McMullen. But he crushed it with Sarah McLachlan.
Holy crap. Now, I thought they just licensed that song. I had no idea that she did that.
So
that's amazing.
And there was a young kid who worked in the music department at Fox who I think suggested some lyrics or wrote some lyrics. I mean, again, I can't remember all the details. But there's a guy who's the third writer on it who was a young kid working in the music department who also got, you know, writing credit on it, and I'm sure got paid.
I mean, that song, he's like, Seamus is probably like the Hugh Grant of About a Boy these days with that one song, you know, where he gets checks every year.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Well, so there's this period of time then. So she's the one in 96, and from like, for like the next 10 years, you kind of branch out in a way where you're not just writing, directing, and acting and producing in your own movies. You're starting to take acting roles in other folks' movies. I mean, Saving Private Ryan being one of them that I want to talk about. But just from a strategic mindset perspective, as you're looking at like, okay, I've just come off of these two films. You know, you're working on No Looking Back probably at the same time that Saving Private Ryan is happening. How are you thinking about that? You know, you say early on, okay, Billy Wilder is the model. I'm going to write, I'm going to direct, I'm going to produce my own movies. Why does acting in other people's films become an option in your mind as something that you want to do?
So after McMullen, I start getting acting offers to act in other people's films.
Yep.
And I was not interested at all. And I really just wanted to do my thing. And fortunately for me, I was able to make She's the One right on the heels of McMullen.
Yep.
And then my third film, No Looking Back, is kind of didn't really work. And it was different from the first two films tonally.
Yeah.
And that it, you know, wasn't a comedy at all. And I had a very tough time putting that movie together. So a real tough time getting a cast attached to that and getting it fully financed.
Yeah.
And at the time, my agents were like, look, if you were to take some of these acting offers that are coming and, you know, act in one or two big Hollywood films, it'll obviously make it so much easier for us to get your films, your own personal films financed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So after the No Looking Back experience, that's when I kind of became more agreeable to, okay, let's take a look at some scripts. One of the first scripts that I get is Saving Private Ryan. And the part that my agents thought I could fight for was the part that Tom Sizemore eventually played, which was the Sarge.
Right.
I read the script and, you know, and quite honestly, you know, the Sarge is a tough part. It's like, you know, there's some heavy duty lifting, yeah, acting wise,
yeah,
in there that I just didn't think I was ready for, you know, not for Steven Spielberg and opposite Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
But there was the part of the wise ass kid from Brooklyn, which I was like, all right, I can do that.
Yeah, feels right.
So I said to my agents, well, would you put me up for the part of Ryben instead? And, you know, they said, okay, yeah, but, you know, you might be too old for that part. And I can't remember if it was, you know, 3 months later, but I can remember, you know, where I was when I got the phone call that said, you're not going to believe this, but you got the part in Saving Private Ryan.
That's amazing. And being on the set of that movie as a director yourself, and I hear this a lot of people that have had that experience of being on the set with Spielberg. Do you come away from that experience saying to yourself, oh, it's interesting how he does this, or man, I didn't think about that? Like, it gives you, it's some education for you going forward as a director.
I got completely spoiled because, you know, 3 years into my career, I get to go to graduate film school on set 66 days, you know, basically looking over his shoulder.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, Steven was a mentor, still a mentor, you know, has always looked at every film I've made, and I send him my scripts. And it started on that set where I basically said, would you mind if I shadowed you and just tried to pick up as much as I can? And he said, go right ahead. So he completely changed my approach with how I work with actors. You know, I was guilty of thinking that the director is always supposed to be directing actors. So after every take, I would make sure I'd give a note or give an idea or ask them to try and do it a little differently. And Steven did none of that. You know, he would give us 3 or 4 takes and let us sort of find the scene. It was so much so that I think after like 2 weeks, you know, he didn't give us any notes as actors. And we went to him at lunch one day and said, hey, you know, are you unhappy with us? Like, how come you're not telling us what to do? And I should say, for 2 weeks, he didn't give us any notes. And then there was a scene where he gave us a ton of notes and kept asking us to do this differently. And we asked him why today all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, because today you didn't have it. You didn't know what the hell you were doing. So I needed to direct you. And explain to us, like, he goes, you know, I hired all professionals. I assume that you've done your homework, but I'm not going to also make the assumption, especially in a scene that might have 3 or 4 or 5 actors, that you're all going to get it perfectly on the first take, you know? So I sit there and I wait for it to click. When the magic happens, I can move on. If the magic isn't happening, then I have to step in. And I thought that's great advice. And, you know, I've made a number of movies and now a couple of shows with young actors, folks with very little experience, and that's what I do. You know, I mean, you never want to step in right after the first take and rattle the confidence of an actor, especially a young actor.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, kind of like equating it to sports. Like, you know, you kind of have to let them get warmed up. That's not to say some people aren't great right out of the gate, but sure, typically it's better to let them have a couple of takes and play and feel comfortable and confident. And I find you get a better performance that way.
No, it's amazing. And so that kind of moment in your history kind of kicks off then over, you know, the next decade or more or two, where when you look at all of the things that you've got your fingers in, you're acting, you're in a slew of romantic comedies, playing kind of the, you know, Life or Something Like It, The Holiday, 27 Dresses. You're finding ways to turn, you know, the stories that you want to tell from your life into television shows yourself, the Fighting Fitzgeralds, the Fitzgerald Family Christmas. But over that time period, now you're getting into television. You're not just acting in other people's stuff, but you're now kind of writing and producing and directing projects on television. How does television, is television a big like contrast for you from the film side? Is there something that surprises you about taking these stories into that medium?
I'd say initially, yes, it was a big contrast. You know, the first thing we did was my brother and I, after McMullen and She's the One, I got a lot of offers to try and turn McMullen into a sitcom, which I didn't want to do. But I was like, you know, I think I might have some ideas for some sitcoms. So my brother and I started a television production company, a development company.
Yeah.
And we sold to NBC a show called The Fighting Fitzgeralds, which was basically kind of, you know, a combination of McMullen and She's the One.
Yep.
Three brothers. And instead we had kind of like the late John Mahoney's kind of father figure.
I mean, Dennehy is hilarious.
And Brian Dennehy. And, you know, we did pretty well with it. We got 12 episodes, which is hard to do.
Yeah.
In network television. But that experience for me as an indie filmmaker was very difficult because, you know, there are a lot of folks on the studio side and the network side, and they all give notes, and they give notes on every line of dialogue.
Yeah.
And I just found it a pretty, you know, for me, creatively an unsatisfying experience. So after that, my brother and I sort of said, forget it. We don't want to do TV anymore. My brother then continued, and he ended up, you know, writing for years on Entourage, which is how I ended up on Entourage.
How cool.
And now he writes for, he's been with the show Blue Bloods for 11 years.
Oh, wow.
But I kind of stayed away until, and it's funny, you know, the acting stuff kind of, you know, has always been great for me as far as like opening new doors and new relationships. I acted for Frank Darabont in his show Mob City.
Yep.
For TNT. On the set of that show, I meet Michael Wright, who's running the network at the time. And he asks if I would ever be interested in doing a television show. And I told him, I said, look, I have this, you know, these two movie ideas that I've been working on for years and haven't been able to really crack because I feel like I have a little bit too much story for a feature. You know, I said, one is about this, you know, division in the police department that my dad worked in, which was called the Public Morals Division. And the other idea is about, these Hell's Kitchen, you know, Irish gangsters, which, you know, my family is from Hell's Kitchen. So I was like, so I've always been fascinated by those two things. And I said, I have this idea where, you know, the main guy from the Hell's Kitchen gangster side is best friends with one of the cops. And it's kind of, that's their journey. He says, I love it. Let's do it. So back to Spielberg. I had, after Private Ryan, I wrote a script for Steven because my father and my uncle had visited the set of Private Ryan. Steven met them. They were telling him stories about what it was like to be a cop in New York in the 60s and 70s. And Steven said, you should make a movie about that. Wow. So knowing Steven's interest in that, when it was time to do Public Morals, I went to Steven and I said, hey, I'm working with Michael Wright on this project. Steven was very good friends with Michael. And Steven says, well, why don't we come on board as well? So so that was great.
That's amazing.
And, you know, that's, even though TNT wasn't, you know, premium cable, you know, they did have commercials. I got to do 11 episodes with a real budget with almost zero creative interference.
That's amazing.
And now, granted, we only got one season. And our final episode never aired. So it kind of, it ends abruptly. You don't get the finale. It was still, from a storytelling standpoint, it was one of the best times I've ever had.
I mean, I have to imagine a season of television on your own terms versus four with them, you know, noting you to death. I think we know which one you'd pick.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And it's funny, you know, even after when doing Public Morals and doing press for it, I was like, I don't ever want to go back and make an indie film. I was like, television was so much fun. It was great. And then, of course, after the show got canceled, I could feel the itch again, wanting to go back and do an indie film.
Are you solely responsible for Connie Britton's success?
That's a good story. No, I would say, you know, maybe me and Ed Norton can take some of the credit. Yeah. So the Connie Britton story is I put an ad in Backstage Magazine for Brothers McMullen. And the ad basically says, you know, low budget, non-union indie, no pay, will feed you. And the great thing about, you know, making movies in New York is, you know, I probably got, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000 headshots from that ad.
Yeah, wow.
So I just started bringing in people to audition. And the part that Connie eventually played, Molly, you know, I bet you I auditioned 25 women before her. And I was really starting to think that maybe the scenes were just terrible.
Yeah.
Because every audition was just wasn't very good. And then Connie came in. And she just destroyed it. And, you know, we joke, like, when Connie was on set, like, you could just tell, like, we had our ringer, you know. Yeah. She was hands down the best of the bunch. Not to take anything away from anyone else, but, you know, Connie's great.
And then she's in No Looking Back, and then she's in the Fighting Fitzgeralds, and so.
Yeah. But the funny thing that happens with Connie is, after that audition, I offer her the part, and I did not know. She told me this story years later, but she was friends with Ed Norton, and he was a, you know, brand new kid out of college, like all of us in New York, trying to make his acting dreams come true. And Connie went to him and said, oh God, you know, I got offered this movie and there's no pay and it's this kid and he's going to be shooting at his parents' house on Long Island.
Oh my God.
I don't know if I should do this. And he apparently said to her, look, what else are you going to do? That's why we're here. We're here in New York to go, you know, be in plays and make movies. You absolutely have to go and do this. You know, maybe you'll get a couple of scenes for your reel. So, you know, Connie obviously says yes and does it. And it's about a year later, Connie is, she now has her career and an agent, and she goes in to audition for this movie, Primal Fear.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, she reads the script and there's this great part in it. And she goes to Ed and she says, hey, has your agent, I mean, who knows, maybe he didn't even have an agent at the time. Have you gone in on Primal Fear yet? And he says, no. She says, there is a part that you will crush. You have to figure out how to get an audition for that part.
So wow.
We all know he gets it. So Ed helped Connie and Connie helped Ed.
That's amazing.
One of those great, that's like amazing, young actors in New York stories.
All right. So let's talk Bridge and Tunnel. So just for folks who, just to give them a high level, it premiered in January on Epics. The finale of the first season airs the same week that this show is going to show up. So the first week of March will be the season finale. Talk to us about, so you wrote and directed all the episodes. Tell us a little bit about the project and how it came to be.
Right. And before I do that, I'll let you know it's on Epics. All the previous 5 episodes are available on demand. And if you can't get Epics on your cable provider, you can get it through Amazon. So
great. And by the way, the first episode, even if you don't subscribe, you can watch on the Epix website for free so you can get a sense. But I predict once you watch the first episode, you're going to want to watch the rest.
All right. So, you know, logline is, it is the summer of 1980 and a group of 6 best friends, 3 guys and 3 girls who all grew up in the same neighborhood, some of them even on the same block. They have all just graduated college. And it is day one upon returning from their respective universities. And they're all moving back home into their parents' houses and looking to either start their first jobs or go into the city to do interviews to try and find their first jobs while getting reacclimated with one another and then dealing with having to move back in and live with your parents after being gone for 4 years. So that's the basic premise. And
it's a great nostalgic. I mean, all of the needle drops of the tracks, the 80s songs, like it has a great nostalgic feel to it. And the actors are, the ensemble cast is really fun to watch. Is this something that had been percolating for a long time? I mean, clearly it takes place in your backyard, so to speak, but not necessarily, you didn't necessarily grow up in that time at that age.
Yeah, I mean, it came from a couple of different places. I mean, the reason to set it in 1980 was, you know, I mean, so I made it with Epics. Michael Wright, who I mentioned earlier, was running TNT. He runs Epics, and he asked me if I had any ideas for a half hour show And he wanted something that would put a smile on your face.
Yeah.
And we talked about some of the shows we were watching that were our favorite shows. We talked about The Crown and Mad Men and Mrs. Maisel. And he's like, you know, we should make this a period show. Mm-hmm. So I suggested 1980 because the late 70s and the early 80s in New York City was always that era that I've been fascinated by. Obviously, you know, I'm 11 years old then. I don't get to experience that.
Right.
But, you know, the art scene and the punk scene and the birth of hip hop and graffiti and fashion and, you know, when Soho and Tribeca were gritty and filled with artists, that was always the time that I wish I personally could have experienced. So I pitched Michael on the idea of, you know, late 70s, 1980, as a way for me to be able to go and recreate New York City at the time. And the idea for the show was, you know, these kids would arrive home, but the show was going to take place in Manhattan.
Right.
COVID hit while we were in sort of in development. And all of a sudden, it looked like the show was going to not happen for a number of reasons. One, you know, it looked like nothing was going to be shooting. And then when we were able to shoot, you know, 1/5 of our budget was going to have to go to our COVID protocols.
Right.
So that was going to be all of the testing, shorter days, smaller crews. So our 8 episodes turned into 6 episodes.
Yep.
And everything that took place in Manhattan, which again was the original sort of selling points of the show, we had to rewrite to take place in their hometown on Long Island because at that time you could not shoot in the city.
Right.
The city was not issuing permits. But in a weird way, it turned out to be a blessing because it kind of forced me to zero in on who these characters were at home with their families and what were their relationships like, as opposed to, you know, let's say all the fun that they were going to have in the city as they pursued their dreams. So, you know, so that was one of the things. And you know, asking about where the ideas come from, connected to that early 80s idea, I kind of, and I've never done this before, I sort of reverse engineered the characters from where I wanted them to end up.
Got it.
You know, our lead character, Jimmy, is a photographer. I knew I wanted to do something about a young assistant photographer shooting fashion in New York in the early 80s. Jill, the other lead, aspires to be a fashion designer. I knew I wanted to play with the fashion world in New York at that time. And then Pags is a guy who wants to be a music attorney. And I mentioned earlier my fascination with, you know, all of the bands that were huge in New York at the time, whether it's Blondie, Talking Heads, Television.
Yeah.
So this was a way for me to, my thinking was, that's where I want to end up in season 3. So who are these characters when I meet them 2 or 3 years prior to those dreams coming true?
Right. So you already, I mean, talk about outlining, right? You already know their arcs for the full, full multiple seasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's super fun. And I love that the timing works out that this week that we launched this episode to folks, the finale is going to be available. So I highly recommend folks seek it out and check it out. It's to me, I always say anything that takes me back to the 80s is these days is like a weighted blanket of nostalgia. So it's fun.
Well, we also, you know, the other thing was like definitely wanted a show that you know, that wasn't depressing and cynical. And
yes.
I, you know, we didn't want people going to bed bummed.
Yeah.
So the goal was, you know, and it was, you know, instinctually as a writer, you know, in trying to create conflict and drama, I think it's easy sometimes to go there, you know, to have the more bombastic scene. But, you know, that was never the intention of the show. So, you know, I talked about that comedy and drama balance before, like being able to keep it light and keep a smile on the audience's face while also, you know, creating conflict was a fun challenge. But I think I found the right tone. So.
No, I think you have, and I think you're right too. I mean, my wife and I, we sit down every couple nights to try to find a movie to watch, and you know, we're in the industry, so we have access to all of these screeners, and there's a lot of amazing movies, but they're all super depressing. They're really downers.
A lot of depressing shit out there right now.
Right? It's really, I mean, and again, great performances, but wow, like it's nice to be able to turn on something that just, it just puts a smile on your face. So I highly recommend people check this out. I want to pivot into Tender Mercies briefly. Clearly there is a 95, ironically, a 95, 96 minute feature length commentary that you've already done for the movie that people can listen to. It's 1983, Tender Mercy. So when do you first see this movie, and what impact does it have on you that first time?
You know, my mom was sort of the movie buff in our house. So she is probably the one who told me to rent it on VHS. Yeah. 1983, I think I'm in ninth grade, so I am definitely not going to see this movie in the theater.
Right.
And it's probably when I am in film school and I'm turning myself on to all sorts of different stories. So I mentioned in the commentary that I have this Texas trilogy of my, you know, three of my, you know, in my top 10 favorite movies of all time. And it's, you know, it's the movie HUD with Paul Newman, Bogdanovich's Last Picture Show, and Tender Mercies. So my mom was a Paul Newman nut, loved Paul Newman. So she turned me on to HUD. And when I fell in love with HUD, that then she said, oh, well, if you like HUD and you like that style of storytelling, you should, you know, and again, HUD isn't as quiet as Tender Mercies. But again, it's a pace that you really don't see in any feature films anymore. I shouldn't say in any, but it just, you don't see it as much.
It reminds me of Nomadland. I don't know if you've seen that yet.
I haven't seen it. I saw the trailer though.
Yeah.
I can see that. So anyhow, so I probably saw it then and fell in love with it. And it's, again, it's one of those films, you know, I mean, I love it so much. I have its theatrical poster in my office next to my Last Picture Show poster.
Nice.
And, you know, I check it out. I used to watch it once a year. Now probably once every couple of years.
What's amazing, and the irony of it all, is much like Brothers McMullen, this is a film that could not find a distributor for a while. Eventually, I mean, different in the sense that at least yours finally got picked up and then it just exploded. This is a movie that they released on three theaters. It doesn't do well. It's kind of a failure. And then it's nominated for 5 Oscars. Duvall wins Best Actor. Horton wins Best Screenplay. And then they try to put it out on video to take advantage of it at that point. No, they try to re-release it in theaters, but it's already on cable and video. And that's where the real life comes out for this film. But still, you know, you look at a movie like yours, a movie like this, the story is as old as time.
Yeah.
And, you know, like William Goldman once said, nobody knows anything in this town. It's just for anybody who is writing, wants to be creative, who's struggling to bring a vision to society in some way, the path to success is filled with rejection and failure. And only when you can continue to stand in the face of rejection and be persistent, as you have been for quite a long time, it seems to be the only path to success.
You really, like, you know, you have to, you know, it isn't a case of wanting to do this. You have to like need to do this.
Yeah.
Because it is way too hard. And look, I'm one of the lucky ones. Like, I hit the lottery on my first film. Now, granted, it took 4 years of writing multiple scripts, making that, you know, scraping together the money to make that movie and all the rejection. But when it happened, I got into the business in about as good a spot as you can get into the business.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed great success for 2 years. You know,
right.
McMullen was, you know, Searchlight's first movie. And then She's the One is Searchlight's, it was their big profitable movie for their second year in existence.
Yeah.
But since then, I've been scraping by for whatever it is, you know, 23, 24 years, trying to get these little movies made and then trying to figure out, you know, the best possible way to try and find an audience if you're not fortunate enough to go back to Sundance and get Searchlight to distribute your film. Right. So it's hard. As you said, it's filled with rejection, but, to get into it, you have to, like, this is what you need to do with your life. There is, you know, it has called you and you are, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, yeah, you have no will against it. You know, you have to.
I mean, outside of outlining or not outlining, if you look back at the history so far and you've got a lot more to come, is there any particular one thing that you would say, man, I wish I had done that or I wish I hadn't done that?
Yeah, I mean, mean, there's a bunch, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I
yeah.
made that movie. I made this movie Ash Wednesday, which we really needed about $10 million and we couldn't get it. So then we were like, well, maybe we could do it for eight. Eventually we got down to 2.5. And I says, you know, I'm like, I know how to make a movie for 25 grand. I can do one for 2.5. 2.5 was nowhere near enough money.
Yeah.
So you just couldn't tell the story with that. So, but I think, you know, I would say I probably have a dozen moments that moments that I wish I could redo. But at the same time, you know, I've never made a film that I didn't end up working with some new person that has now become part of my filmmaking community that I have then worked with again.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, even if the movie stinks and even if it's a miserable experience, you know, you're going to A, learn something from it, but more times than not, you'll work with that person. They like a perfect example is, you know, Will Rexer, my DP, who I've worked with for, you know, 17, 18 years now. I met him on that movie Looking for Kitty,
yeah.
Which, you know, again, not a very good movie. It was kind of experimental. It was sort of that actually was a little bit of an outline, only without a script.
Right, right.
But we met on that and became best friends, and he's been my DP ever since. So I can't say I wish I didn't make Looking for Kitty. You know, maybe I wish I didn't release it.
No, you're right. I mean, I think you are the product. We are the product, the collective we, of any failure, success, etc. And yes, in this town, the people are the most important piece. And if you have an opportunity to work with somebody and the project sucks, but that's a new relationship. Plus,
it's a good time. Like being on set and working with your friends and working with actors, you know, even if you're standing, you know, on a street corner in New York and it's, you know, it's 20 degrees out and the wind is whipping, it's still a blast. Like you're living the dream. So even when they don't work out, you know, you always look back on, you know, the great times you had on set. If you're not having a great time on set, then you probably just don't have the right temperament for this, and it probably isn't the career for you.
Yeah.
Because it is fun.
Well, listen, the Tender Mercies commentary is a great listen. I think, you know, for anybody, who hasn't seen the movie, it's a great opportunity to check it out and hear your thoughts as you watch the film. I want to thank you for taking all this time to not only record that, but to sit down and talk about, you know, your history here. There's so many amazing stories. The list of films and television shows that you were writing and directing is expansive. I encourage folks to check some of these films out, as well as Bridge and Tunnel, which the finale airs this week on Epix. And just want to thank you for the time, Ed. It's been really great to talk.
Appreciate it, Paul. No, it was a lot of fun.
What a conversation. Yes, I want to thank Ed Burns for taking the time to do all of the things he did. Don't forget, Bridge and Tunnel, the finale airs this week, the first week of March 2021 on Epix, which you can also get through Amazon. If you haven't seen The Brothers McMullen, if you haven't seen She's the One, two of his first two movies that really represent his voice, please check those movies out, as well as his long list of acting credits, including none other than Saving Private Ryan, among others. As always, thanks for listening. The commentary for 1983's Tender Mercies is available as a separate episode now, so check that out. The movie you can find on HBO Max, as well as physical media, which still does exist in this day and age. This is Paul Davidson saying thanks for joining us. Don't forget the three R's of podcast success, as far as I'm concerned. Rate, review, and retweet. Let friends know, spread the word, and we'll see you next week here on The Sidetrack.